listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Hello, hello. Good to be back with all of you. I have with me today Father Tim Grumbach, and we're going to be talking about an endocrinologist who talks about some of the impact of a trans therapy. He's also a pediatrician. We'll be coming up talking as well about some changes post the Me Too movement and how men are interacting a little differently with women, especially elderly women in their need. And we'll also be diving into some pro-life apologetics. Let's get into some pro-life answers to some really difficult, at times, pro-abortion talking points. So we'll go ahead and dive right in, but also just a teaser for those who are going to be with us a little later, we're going to be talking about embryonic research, especially regarding embryos that are frozen after conceiving them through IVF, and what happens when a couple divorces. So we'll be weighing in from a Catholic bioethics perspective.
Yeah, we're looking at things that Jesus didn't say anything about in Scripture, but it comes from the tradition of the church and our understanding of the human person created in the image and the likeness of God.
Absolutely. So I want to start to really here by addressing this new piece of information that I saw come out essentially from the University of Colorado. After the Me Too movement, research has been done showing that men are actually afraid to give women, even elderly women, CPR, say when they pass out or something's going on, that women are in need. And I kind of found this odd. I thought, okay, well, that's just one piece of research. Really, is that true? And I started asking men, you know, around me, and they said, yeah, I wouldn't. And just imagine what you would be accused of today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've also got to wonder, you know, have we created a masculinity that's afraid to take these risks, to care for other people for fear of what would be said, what would be accused, the image that would be created? We need to recreate a masculinity that's not afraid of these, you know, these false accusations, not afraid of these risks, but is willing to enter into them in order to protect life.
And the reality is, I think about it from the perspective of our faith, that our faith already is controversial. From the very beginning of Christianity, Jesus himself was controversial. He didn't do things the way other people want. Even his own apostles would question him and constantly have to be taught and have everything explained to them. And I think the reality is whether you're afraid to interact too closely with a woman after the Me Too movement, or you're afraid to speak out against abortion because there's a huge wave of just radical pro-abortion ideologies and gender ideologies sweeping the nation, we have to be willing to break through and be bold and controversial without being overly confrontational.
Mm-hmm. I can so relate to this, though, as a priest, and the way that our ministry has been changing over the last decade or two because of accusations, because of mistakes made by individual priests, by individual bishops, is that we're almost treading very lightly now in the kinds of relationships that we can have. And so there's a certain risk in entering into relationship these days and becoming close to anybody.
Right.
One of our major concerns has become, how do I relate to female parishioners, for example? Mm-hmm. But with the rise of the LGBT culture and whatnot, we almost have to wonder, what are people going to be thinking if we become close to male parishioners as well?
Right.
And so, with the rise of the Me Too movement and the LGBT culture and everything like that, it's becoming very difficult for us if we're worried constantly about accusations and the risk that comes with relating to people. It's becoming very difficult to relate to people on a human level.
It's a climate of fear. And I remember even prior to the most recent sex abuse scandal breaking, a dear priest friend, when I was just a little girl, I remember hearing him say to my mom one time, he said, there are days where I walk down the side of the road on the sidewalk wearing my Roman collar and people go to the other side of the street. You know, priests feel like they can't be close to children. They can't be close to women. They can't be close to men today. There's this. And then here we hear this study from the University of Colorado. We have to break through that fear while also having accountability at the same time for our actions.
Yeah, and I think it's going to come down to, you know, a man's understanding of his own masculinity and what he's called to, and a certain protection of life and a passing on of life. Is that, you know, if we don't have that solid understanding of what masculinity is and what it's calling us to, what it's challenging us towards, then of course we're going to see what the culture is expecting of us rather than what our own masculinity and the way that God has created us is, you know, calling us towards, rather than merely expecting something of us.
That's Father Tim Grumbach. I am Timory. You're listening to Trending with Timory. Dr. Paul Hertz is a pediatrician and endocrinologist, and he recently came on Fox doing a number of interviews, really talking about the impact and also just what the current science is regarding transgender therapy. So whether that's sex changes, right, where the anatomy of the man or woman is being manipulated to look like the anatomy of the other person, because the reality is you can't create that anatomy to function per se how it is meant to function, or where we're doing extreme hormone replacement therapy. Now, he's specifically speaking out because he's saying there's a lot of bad science and misleading information out there that's being implemented as kind of the way of the land in terms of how we operate in transgender issues. But he's also coming at it from the perspective of a pediatrician and the impact on children as well. So, Father Tim, what really stood out when you're hearing kind of some of his thoughts here?
Well, just the expectation in the culture now to allow young people to make transitions and to accommodate them, and hearing that there are certain laws being put into place. I believe in Canada, certain parts of Canada, there are also laws that if a parent is not willing to accept that their child wants to transition from one gender to another, that the government can come in and take the children away,
right?
Because the children don't belong to the parents. The children, you know, in a sense, it's a very dare we say Marxist understanding of childbearing, is that it in a sense it belongs to the government. So that not allowing a child to make this transition in a, you know, medically, you know, where the research medically simply isn't there to say that this is safe and this is effective, you know, even from a mental standpoint. That the government is beginning to force this upon us.
The government attitude is if a child identifies in most states at this point, even in the United States, if a child identifies as something other than its biological sex, you're supposed to, whether you're a doctor or a psychologist, do nothing but affirm that. And the automatic assumption is to jump into some sort of medical intervention to change the sex of the child on a chemical, and physiological looking level right away. And this is what's scary, because essentially this endocrinologist, you know, he's working with cell biology, physiology. He's working as a pediatrician. This is someone who's well educated and looking at the research and is also a professor teaching in these realms in St. Louis at medical centers. He's talking about how essentially we're not seeing fully what the long-term impact is of much of these studies. And he was talking about how there was actually really only one small study done that talks about interference when a child is essentially prior to puberty saying that they identify with something other than their biological sex. Essentially, this very small limited study showed that if intervention was made to encourage the questioning of the biological sex, then when that encouraged questioning took place from an outside source, there was widespread adoption of some sort of transgenderism. But that's only if the intervention took place to encourage the questioning. The reality is that we actually have years of data specifically dealing with gender identity disorder, showing that actually if you step in and start to give encouragement and affirmation of the person, that often the child goes through puberty and identifies with their sex. So it was only when there was a challenge to, yeah, you should question this, that suddenly the kids continue to question it into a transgender identity later on.
Yeah, especially when it's happening at younger ages, when the children still barely have an identity of themselves as human persons.
Yeah.
it becomes something that the parents are encouraging. The parents are leading these children into thinking that this is the transition that, you know, that they must make because, you know, a little boy likes to play with dolls or something like that.
Right.
I know it's often more dramatic than that, and that there is sometimes there's a mental illness involved, and sometimes there's a tremendous cultural pressure.
The boys could be afraid of interacting with other little boys. Right, they could have a difficult time in engaging in different types of sports. And a lot of the time, boys who struggle with gender identity disorders are actually little boys who are not as athletic, don't have as good relationships with their fathers. Maybe the father's actually doing the opposite of affirming the little boy, but maybe picking on him because he does not see him kind of becoming necessarily as manly, or maybe the father's not taking enough interest. And not to blame fathers, but these are very common trends that we see among men who have come out years later sharing their experience, but also from the way that the social sciences have shown the progression with gender identity disorders.
And we are seeing this playing out in the world of sports as well.
Right.
You know, just as you mentioned that sometimes if a young man or a young woman is, you know, not as adept at a certain sport as they one would want them to be, but also just coming into the high school and collegiate level and seeing, you know, this, let's just call it what it is, this very strange, ridiculous expectation that biological males can compete legally against biological females at the same level. And we're seeing certain statistics like men, you know, trans, I can't even get it straight these days, but biological men who claim to be female who will transition into women's sports.
Right.
And there are certain expectations that they will lower their testosterone levels in some cases, but not all. And that we've seen cases where there's one case in Division II track and field where there's a biological male who's racing against women who he was, you know, ranked 350th, like 200th at best.
In the men's division.
In the men's division. And then he enters into the women's division and he is the national champion now.
So, and this is the reality of it. This endocrinologist and pediatrician is talking about how it's one thing to administer hormones to a woman, giving her female hormones to help treat mm-hmm. some sort of disease or disorder or imbalance in the hormones. But it's a completely different new territory that's not been worked out through endocrinology mm-hmm. and so forth, good science, where we're now giving cross-sex hormones. Again, it's a big difference in the two areas, yet we are giving high levels of cross-sex hormones as never done before. And the reality is that there's right now a single intervention protocol that we now have over 50 centers across the nation implementing essentially bad and limited science that are completely uncharted territories with little knowledge of the long-term impact on the body. But we already see some long-term impacts. Infertility issues, major women's health issues, because we know as women, a sign of our biological full bodily health is determined whether or not we are ovulating during our child-rearing years. Not that we're having children, but ovulating. In addition to that, there's a lot of links to cardiovascular disease among these cross-sex hormone use.
And it begins with the same issue as looking at certain forms of contraception, which are denying something that is healthy, that is working healthily, and pointing to it as a certain kind of health care is, in fact, what is happening is it's destroying and harming what is actually working physiologically in a healthy way.
Right, absolutely. That's Father Tim Grumbach. You're listening to Trending with Timory. These are really important topics having to do with transgender issues, and we talk about it a lot on Trending, and it's always a blessing to hear from so many of you throughout my week over and over again. I hear people, whether it's someone who has a family member or a friend's family member who experiences same-sex attraction, they're trying to show, I love that person, I appreciate that person, but I don't condone their actions, finding that balance. And over the last couple weeks, we had Dr. Michael Gasparo, who you also know, Father, too.
Yeah, he's a good friend from ministry at St. Monica's.
That's right. Yeah. I just elevated him to doctor again.
Yeah. Oh,
he's
yeah.
not doctor. I'm maybe making a prediction, but he works with the Breakthrough Clinic. You can find them at thebreakthroughclinic.com. And they're working with science that has been proven and present for years, showing really that we need to work in people who are experiencing gender dysphoria, same-sex attraction, helping to heal wounds from the past, whether it's sex addictions, whether it has to do with trauma that's taken place, so much or OCD, and many other things that are present in many of these people's lives.
And I'm so grateful that Michael was able to come onto the show and to share his witness, not just here's some information, but here's the way that that information has transformed, you know, his own life. And so that we can hear that, you know, the people who are involved in this, in the research, in the study, but also in the encounter with people, that they're, you know, they can be living through their own experience and be able to share that they have had an encounter with Christ and his healing and want others to experience that as well.
If you didn't catch those episodes, please head over to radiotrending.com, go to the guest page and find Michael Gasparo, because his testimony as Father Tim is so impactful. And then also his work as an associate marriage and family therapist is truly helping many people across the nation. I want to talk now about just the current pro-life climate. For those who don't know, and I think it's a little hard to ignore, whether you're on a university campus, in the churches, or just reading the news anymore, the abortion laws are sweeping the nation. Whether it's a state, for example, like Chicago, who's considering very radical pro-abortion laws up to birth, or, for example, New York, or you have other states, I mean, so many of them that are implementing incredibly strong pro-life laws across the nation. For example, we've seen Iowa just a couple years ago pass incredible heartbeat laws. We're seeing Alabama. We're seeing, you know, some laws where an abortion clinic's being forced to close because they're not meeting basic health standards. Mm-hmm. We need to be stronger in our pro-life answers to so many of these issues today.
That's right. And the pro-choice side finds ways to just kind of reach at an emotional level and peak this almost violent reaction to the things that are coming through in Alabama and Missouri and these other states. I remember seeing on Twitter just a few weeks ago, it was Chris Evans, who actually plays Captain America in the Marvel movies, reacted against, I think it was Missouri's latest law that the governor was planning to sign into law, actually. And he simply went something like, you know, what is happening? And, you know, all of his fans came and were like, yeah, you're right, you know, fight for women's rights and you know, women's health care and everything like that. And it just struck me as so strange that this actor who portrays this very, you know, who's supposed to be like the American hero, Captain America. I'm like, Chris, I'm sure there are some pro-life people who would love to sit down with you and talk to you about what it means to be a man who defends the defenseless.
Well, notice he really doesn't have any strong comment or
right,
argument.
Yeah, that's why
I think we need to be ready to respond to some of these talking points. Yeah. And one of the talking points we're hearing now again, and we didn't really hear this as much because people weren't scared of losing abortion. We haven't heard this argument as much since Roe versus Wade back in the 1970s. But people are using scare tactics again and saying, well, pregnancy kills. Women die from pregnancy. Here's the reality, you guys. If pregnancy really killed, then we would have most of our OBGYNs actually working to perform abortions. But the reality is over 85% of them do not perform abortions. They don't even recommend it out, many of them, for abortions because it's not basic women's health care for the life of a mother, because pregnancy isn't a disease. And here's the reality. So many of our medical professionals, OBGYNs across the nation, have come out, even in New York, saying that abortion is not medically necessary to save the woman's life. In fact, medical conditions, whether it's a pre-existing condition or a condition that takes place because of something happening during the pregnancy, prior to 20 weeks, is not significant, in very, very rare occasions, significant enough to cause a serious risk to the mother. So then we're talking about pregnancies at the point of getting toward the last trimester, let's say 20 weeks after a fertilization. We're at that point, in some places, we're getting very close to viability, actually, where the child could be delivered early, and that would not be an abortion, where an abortion is intentionally killing the baby and delivering a dead baby rather than delivering a baby prematurely to maybe save the mom and the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're looking at this opinion piece that came from the New York Times by Dr. Warren Hearn,
yes.
Who the name of the the article is pregnancy kills, abortion saves lives. And it suggests, you know, it mentions that actually the way they describe it, he specializes in late abortion services. That's a euphemism if I've never heard one. And the very last line of this article is vagueness and confusion are tools of tyranny. And if a specialist in late abortion services is not vagueness and euphemism, I don't know what is. And to hear a late term abortion doctor, I hesitate to even call someone who specializes in late abortions a doctor, that they would write an article that says, you know, that pregnancy kills and abortion saves lives. That's one of the most disgusting things I've ever heard.
Yeah. And I have to reemphasize that there's never any medical necessity after 20 weeks, essentially, from fertilization, or we could say 22 weeks from the woman's last period, where there is a medically necessary abortion. So this is coming from a late-term abortionist who's claiming this. It's just not true. And so it's scary when people talk about medical issues for pregnant women, because they say, oh, well, we'll just give something to the baby to end the pregnancy, or they'll say, we'll give something to end the pregnancy, and then your body will absolve the tissue from the pregnancy. These are the exact words we hear people saying. The reality is that abortion is what ends life. That is the end product. And women do not medically need abortion in order to live. You know, I even think of examples like preeclampsia, where women actually experience high levels of blood pressure rate,
blood pressure, right?
And it can actually cause a seizure during pregnancy. One of my dearest friends actually experienced this recently, and it's very, very, very dangerous. However, if you know it ahead of time, you can do a premature birth, you can go in and do a C-section, and it's worse when it's not caught ahead of time. But you know, we have to recognize that we cannot put one life above the other. And that's what so much of our world wants to do anymore.
Yes, and to actual focus on actual women's health care, to care for these issues that arise during pregnancy. And you know, no one will dispute that, of course, you know, pregnancy requires tremendous risk. You know, that a woman is making such a great sacrifice by entering into that. And that's why, you know, we understand it within our faith that, you know, it's something that has to rise out of love, but that it doesn't always do so. But it's meant to be a time in a woman's life in which, very painfully, like the cross, they come into this experience of love and sacrifice. And if we focus merely on how to rid the woman of something that is you know, taking over her body, rather than encouraging her and focusing on the issues of actual health care and helping her to walk through this experience of, you know, a love that looks like a cross, then we're really missing out on what it means to actually practice women's health care.
Absolutely. Well, and let's take one challenging circumstance where there is a serious threat to a woman's life.
Right.
And that could be in the case of a tubal pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Now, not every, also known as ectopic pregnancy, where the baby does not end up implanting inside of the uterus where it's supposed to be grown and nourished, where it gets stuck for whatever reason. Sometimes there could be over sexual activity that has caused damage to the area. There could be scarring the fallopian tubes from contraception and past abortions. There can be a number of things, but a tubal pregnancy, or by no cause of the woman's, you know, own actions as well, this could happen. But this happens in around 1% of pregnancies. And what happens is that baby is stuck in the fallopian tube. And if at a certain point the baby continues to grow, it can create the bursting of the fallopian tube potentially, and therefore extreme health risks, possibly even death of the mother or the death of the child. Now, there are some cases where the pregnancies end up okay. However, in most cases, what has to happen is the church acknowledges this. The baby could be removed from the tube. That early in development, the child will not be able to live outside of the womb. Medically, you could give as much attention as you can to the point where the child will naturally die, because it's way before viability. And that saves both the life of the mother and preserves the life of the child naturally. However, many people say, well, we're just going to abort that child. That's a direct killing. There's a difference between a removal and the inability to live outside the womb. but give proper attention and the direct killing through abortion.
Yeah, it's almost along the circumstances as well of other situations in which the law of double effect comes into play, where a certain illness or other issue can be dealt with directly, which may result in the death of the child in the womb.
Right.
While it's not a direct abortion, the church recognizes that, yes, this is almost an unjust situation that a family would find themselves in, especially the woman bearing the child. But to focus on the health of the woman, even if it comes at the death of the child, rather than willing the death of the child, that the church recognizes that as a very important law of double effect within moral ethics.
Hey, there's a difference between heroically choosing to forego cancer treatment while you're pregnant for the life of your child, or maybe you choose to still have a cancer treatment and the child might die, but you don't abort the child and then receive the cancer treatment. There's a big difference, as you're saying, in that law of double effect.
Timmery will be right back. Send her a tweet at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
I have to tell you, this next topic that we are about to take up is not one that I am able to talk about lightly. You know, abortion is so disturbing, but when we get to the place of manipulation in the creation of life and then just the intentional destruction for designer babies, we're going to be talking about the thousands of frozen embryos and the crisis and confusion that IVF brings about in just a couple minutes here. But we're also later in the show going to be talking about two, essentially in recorded history, the smallest premature baby actually born right here in San Diego where I live at Sharp Mary Birch Hospital. Absolutely incredible. This baby is alive and kicking and has recently gone home at 5 months, weighing 5 pounds after before only weighing the weight of barely even an apple. So we'll be coming up with that awesome story and how it relates really to the abortion climate. But Father Tim, you sent this over. There's a lot of debate taking place on the level of the legal law and in the court systems over what to do with the frozen embryos that now exist. They've been created via IVF, and I'm just going to briefly mention that one of the reasons the church is against IVF is because we create multiple embryos and then you implant them, see how many live, and say, oh, well, you have 4 babies that are surviving in your womb. How many do you want to keep? And the others are aborted. And not only that, but we also create human life in a petri dish outside of the one flesh union that we are called to in marriage. So we're going to set that aside for the debate today so that we can really focus on the frozen embryos and the crisis this is creating.
Right. And in the church's teaching, it points out that this is really, in some ways, an unjust situation that has almost no solution, looking at these frozen embryos, which we consider to be human persons, that they are distinct human organisms. And some people will say, well, they don't have a consciousness, that they don't have any agency to act, that they don't have a personality and whatnot. And we can point to all of those reasons. It's not being exactly what determines personhood, but that these are human beings that, you know, even though they've been created in a laboratory, that they are still loved into creation by God, even if not by humans.
This is one of those areas I just don't understand. I look at God, I'm like, God, you could have allowed it so that it didn't work when these laboratories were trying to create these babies. Like, and I know other people are going to say, like, why would you allow this to happen? You know, I don't get this one. And that's where it's so hard, because we have to submit in obedience to the church's tough response to these situations.
Yeah, I want to say also, too, that I do know some families who have practiced IVF and are raising children who were born out of this situation, and, you know, very loving families who, you know, I don't know if they were directed by their pastor or whatnot, that it would be okay, which is very troublesome.
And is not according to the church's
teaching, but these are still children loved into creation by God. And we love these families. We walk with these families, and I don't walk into their home and be, oh, that's the child who was, you know, created through IVF, right? These are children and families that I love and care for. So we're not saying that anybody who is born through this process is somehow less human.
Yeah, we're saying it's morally not licit to go through the process or to advise the process, but we still acknowledge the humanity of the unborn. Right. And that's what's so powerful in the church's teachings, is that especially in Dignitatis Personae, mm-hmm. the church has clarified that these are real human persons. Even JP2 years ago, back in the 90s and early 2000s, talked about how we have to acknowledge the reality of personhood. And in fact, we should be arguing for personhood under state and national law for these children. And so here's where the dilemma lies. Mm-hmm. The church is very clear on this. You can't just adopt an embryo to give it life and to allow the development to continue. You can't just say this is, okay, all these frozen thousands, you guys, thousands of frozen embryos are being preserved through nitrogen coolers, essentially. We can't just say, oh, well, this couple, we know a great Catholic couple who wants to have children. We can't just say, yeah, why don't you just implant one of these embryos? The church actually outright acknowledges it's impossible to resolve this situation that we have put ourselves in because we've manipulated nature, and there's no moral response for really trying to find a way out of it at this point.
And they recognize it with the very powerful word that it is an injustice that cannot be resolved. And so this is coming up because we're looking at an article about a case in October of 2017, so almost a couple years ago now, where a former husband and wife are in a custody battle of sorts over frozen embryos. And the question becomes, you know, well, is it important that their decision to procreate has already been made? And so procreation has happened, and now we must side on the side of life and find some way to bring this embryo into its full humanity, which it already has, to let it grow or to destroy it. And it seems that the ex-husband wants to bring this child into life, while the ex-wife is more on the side of, you know, I already have children, I can't care for any others, I don't want this child to be raised, so it would be better for it to be destroyed. And it's becoming quite the court battle, unfortunately, putting more tension even into that relationship. But it seems that there are lawyers on the one side that is asking to destroy the life of this embryo who are worried about its implications for abortion law.
That's what's fascinating, because even just a couple years ago, those who have been listening to Trending, we talked about Nick Love and Sofia Vergara. If I remember correctly, she's a Scientologist, both of them quite famous. And they went through, right, a separation, mm-hmm. and they also went through the battle over the legal rights of their child. And Nick wanted to keep rights to the child so that the baby could be born. Sophia didn't want the child, wanted the child to be aborted. And so a lot of people are saying, well, wouldn't it be the moral thing to do to allow the person who wants the child to keep the child in reality? But the problem is that what do we do with regard to personhood? If the child is acknowledged as a person, then that actually weighs in regarding the abortion debate. And so this is a huge situation for many people, because we're getting into moral reality, we're getting into the law and court systems. And the reality is that currently the court agrees that the frozen embryo, the frozen baby, is more than just, you know, a material good, but won't acknowledge personhood.
Right. And that is a major concern, that if, as the church already does, recognizing the personhood of these frozen embryos as individuals willed and loved into creation by God, that if the, you know, legal system, if the government recognizes these as persons, then what more will we say about, you know, the children who are in the womb? We'll no longer be able to say that, you know, this frozen embryo is a person, but an embryo in the womb is not a person.
Right.
And so it's almost as if they are coming to the defense of the destruction of this embryo in order to come to the defense of Roe v. Wade, which is a terrifying thought, that this legislation is more important than the human person.
You know, I keep looking back to what the church has taught and clarifying. There's no good solution. You know, Pope John Paul II said there's no licit solution, no morally licit solution to these frozen embryos. However, he goes on, quote, to say that they need to be protected by law as persons. And it makes me wonder if, although there's no morally licit way to do something with these frozen embryos, maybe these frozen embryos and the court battles will one day be what brings about a legal protection, and these lives created so wrongly will live to do this justice for humanity, even though they're being denied the rights to their mother and father.
Right, right. Yeah, can we imagine if these were able to grow up into children and adults and have their place in the world that they so rightly deserve, since they've been loved and willed into creation in a way that we weren't expecting, that they could come and have a voice in the world and hopefully be able to grow up and be eloquent towards the injustice of what's happening.
But again, that's an area the church says we can't, because then that would be encouraging the creation of human life and the destruction of life that's via abortion and the IVF process. And this is part of the issue too. So many people, you know, I wish we could dive deeper into this, but you guys, just to touch briefly, I know so many couples who have experienced infertility over the years, and it has been a point of contention in marriages, broken marriages, in just the overall joy and happiness. And I can't tell you, that being said, how many people, religious and non-religious alike, at coffee shops, on airplanes, who I have spoken to, who went through years of infertility crisis and eventually turned to IVF. You guys, the success rate of IVF is so incredibly low that many of the couples who go through it end up saying they wish they hadn't. Or they recognize, this actually wasn't right. I love the child that might have been created, but the process wasn't right. It wasn't human. It was hard on my body. Or it was even harder to keep going through the process over and over, creating super ovulation in the body that's not meant to occur, and then never be able to have a child even after that.
Yeah, and it's important for us, especially those of us who are in pastoral ministry, to be walking with these couples facing infertility and who so greatly desire children. And no doubt, God puts that desire on a human heart, but also to recognize, you know, where is our sinfulness finding its way into that desire as well, where the desire for a child is could be a selfish thing, or like, I want a child to care for, and it becomes this need love in which, you know, I need this person to love me. I need somebody to love me. And, you know, we can even look at the culture of, that's what pets have become as well, is that we have these animals who cannot betray us in the way that a human can, but they need us. And so sometimes that can work its way as a temptation into the human heart between a husband and a wife who are unable to have children, but so long for it because God has put the desire in them, but that we must find a way to walk with them and remind them that this may be a cross that God is asking them to carry, to grow in a cruciform type of love, but ultimately not desiring the children for their own, for the wife and husband's sake, but for the child's own sake.
And I pose this challenge. I know so many people say, I couldn't imagine just adopting. I want my own child. But sometimes suffering calls us to think outside of our circumstances and think about those children. I think about the children in China who at 13 years old are being put on the streets if they are living in the orphanage and are now considered, you know, legal adults. We pray for these children, and I pray for everyone who's experiencing infertility.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Okay, it's time to dive into some more pro-life apologetics here, leading forward in our pro-life arguments. I want to come first to this micro baby that was born down in San Diego. Father Tim, it's incredible. That's Father Tim Grumbach with me today from St. Augustine Parish in Los Angeles. This baby was born at 23 weeks. The woman came in with high blood pressure, had preeclampsia, which essentially is a very dangerous and scary medical condition surrounding pregnancy, where, again, the high blood pressure occurs and seizures can take place, as I mentioned early. So what did they do? Instead of having an abortion, they delivered the baby prematurely. The belief was that the baby would only live maybe an hour. And after the first hour, the nurses told the dad, okay, enjoy the second hour. And now the baby has lived 6 months and is now going home this past week.
I can only imagine how agonizing that must have been for the family to know that they have that opportunity, though, to show love for this 1 hour. And then it goes to 2 hours, and how agonizing that must have been, how, again, cruciform that must have been, but how beautifully they're going to be able to look back on it as little Sabi, you know, tiny but mighty, continues to grow, and they'll be able to look back at what was required of them to love this child whom they expected only to love in this world for an hour, and how beautifully God can use these moments like this, where he, you know, perhaps he didn't say, I want it to be this way, but look at what I can do with it, yeah. rather.
Look so, what I can do with this yeah. life. And what a testament. You know, here we see Alabama, Missouri, Louisiana, Iowa, Ohio protecting life, preventing, you know, abortion through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy, preventing late-term abortion, passing heartbeat laws. And then we see abortion being passed up to birth in Illinois, in New York, in other states who are proposing similar legislation. And yet this baby literally weighed the weight of an apple, 8.6 ounces. It's being referred to as a micro baby. And it was actually half the weight of most 23-week-old babies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And against all odds, the baby survived. And there was no abortion that took place. And the mother is healthy.
And I wonder how many voices on the side of abortion would say, how could you dare put a child through that? How could you dare put a family through that? And, you know, when they don't have the language of, and the reality of being able to say, you know, look what God is capable of doing in a situation like this. Look at these miracles that are possible. They may not look like miracles like you think they should look like, but look what God is capable of doing and the kind of love that God is capable of calling people towards.
Right.
And, you know, how dare we speak of, you know, how dare you put that child through that?
And yet, in most cases such as these, the children would have been aborted. In the case of my friend who had preeclampsia, she very well could have died, could have had major, yeah. major seizures when she was having her child. She's had another child. Yeah. And still, we have to recognize that abortion is not the answer. Abortion is not the answer in our society, yet we justify it. We justify it based on medical conditions. And, you know, let's say that this baby only lived an hour. Half an hour, 3 weeks. Who are we to say that that baby should die because the baby has some sort of medical diagnosis or the mother did? The reality is that there's value on each and every single human life. And not only that, the woman and the man's soul are in a better state to not have the abortion, even if the child lasts a shorter period of time.
Yeah, and one of the delightful parts of the telling of the story is not just how it affected the lives of the mother and the father, but also the staff at the
yes.
hospital, that they're always, you know, kind of thinking about how's Sabi doing? We want to know how she's doing. And there, you know, there's a great picture of her with like a little graduation cap
it's
on
so cute.
As she's coming out of the NICU, it looks like. You know, how beautiful it is for those who are suffering to see the transformation happen in the faces of those who are caring for them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's the miracle that we miss. I've had a beautiful opportunity to go in and to spend some time with a parishioner who, you know, has been suffering a lot through illness for many, many years. And when I go and visit this person and bring the anointing of the sick, I ask them, you know, how does it feel to be the blessed one in this room? Because this is what Jesus speaks about.
Right.
And this person told me, I'll tell you what the real blessing is, you know, Father Tim. The real blessing is I get to see the faces of the people who care for me transform as they learn how to love again.
Yeah, like in a different way yeah. through their suffering,
yeah,
your suffering.
To watch this person suffering and to care for them, you know, that transforms me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if they're not being healed with the miracle that I want, they get to witness a miracle in my eyes as I see, you know, Jesus is in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so how beautiful to hear the story that these the staff at this hospital were working so powerfully, so beautifully that they were able to help bring, you know, Sabi into life and in a healthy way, that their lives were transformed by the miracle of this life.
You know, and it makes me think of the common pro-life acronym that we use in pro-life apologetics called SLED. I've seen many versions of this. One of the versions I attribute to Stephen Schwartz, who wrote The Moral Question of Abortion. But we commonly use this in pro-life apologetics, and it's something I teach in a lot of my apologetics training. And I think that it really relates to this microbaby that was born, some of the other abortion issues we were talking about earlier. SLED stands for, the S stands for size, the L for level of development, E for environment, and D for degree of dependency. And essentially what SLED allows us to do is in pro-life arguments to defend for the person, right, the person that's present in that abortion decision. So, for example, people could have said that Sabi, this baby that was born in San Diego, should be aborted because not only was it 23 weeks rather than 40 weeks gestation, but actually it was half the weight it should have been for a 23-week baby. But who's to determine who should be aborted and not based on the size of a human being? You know, we justify abortion that big people can pick on little people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually talking to my dad about, you know, this case of Sabi very recently. And he said, well, I guess people can't say that that's not a, a baby in there anymore.
Right.
You know, so you know, especially at that time, and we can look at, you know, I'm sure we'll get to viability in a little bit, but you know, to know the size of the children at that point of gestation in the womb, and to be able to say, look, there's a person who can survive there.
Right. And then we have the Ellen sled for level of development. So that's saying that, is a 20-year-old more developed than a 10-year-old? So therefore, is a 20-year-old more human, more of a person than a 10-year-old? We shouldn't be determining whether or not someone should be denied or given the right to live outside the womb based on their development. I always make the joke, you know, I grew up dancing and I wasn't able to go on to point, wear point shoes, right, until a certain bone in my ankle was developed. Did that make me less a person because of that? Because the babies at a certain point develop everything they will by about 8 weeks in the womb and just need to continue to be grown and nourished. Mm-hmm. And so should we just abort babies after eight weeks because everything's there that'll be present in the womb?
Yeah, and especially for even men, you know, certain development in their brain goes on into their, you know, early 20s, is it not?
Men and women, 25. Yeah. The prefrontal cortex doesn't develop till 25,
yeah,
older.
So as I'm preparing couples for marriage, I'm looking at the men thinking, you know, especially when they're younger couples, like there's still some development that needs to happen. It's going to happen within the sacrament of marriage. But there's, you know, this couple has to be aware that there's development and there's growth that needs to happen in the sacrament, you know, as opposed to, you know, older couples who are a little more set in their ways, right? And right. So it's a beautiful thing to see that, you know, development happens for so long, and for us to make this kind of discrimination against life based on the level of development, where do you draw that line?
Where do you draw that line? And I think that that's where SLED is really helpful, because so many people try to dehumanize. And I think a lot of people today recognize the humanity of the unborn, but acknowledge abortion as a necessary evil. So we have to rehumanize the unborn, the preborn child, to people. So that E in the acronym SLED stands for environment. Does being inside a house make you more or less a person than being outside? And I think this is really relevant to, I mean, we're seeing, what is it, Chicago, Illinois is looking at passing and making it so that partial birth abortion can take place again, where you flip the baby so that the feet come out first, and you can, as long as you kind of punctured the baby's head, it's okay to have that abortion because the baby's not fully out of the mother's womb. So we justify killing in the womb but not outside of it. So that has to do with environment. If we look at D, degree of dependency is the last letter in that SLED acronym. And should we determine essentially whether or not you're a person, who you are, whether you should live on the degree of dependency? Many women say, well, this child's developed on me. You know, it's using my resources, my nutrients in order to live. Therefore, I should kill it. Yet, Father Tim, we know, you and I both know, 35-year-olds who are still living with parents, dependent on them for nutrition, to help them make decisions for a house, you know, a roof over their head. And we could, so should we kill those lousy 35-year-olds who are still living with their parents, not working?
Yeah, aside from the issue of perpetual adolescence, we also have the issue of looking at someone who with, you know, maybe disability or other developmental issues, or somebody who's in a coma. Are they less a person because they don't have the same body functions that anybody else who's not in a hospital bed?
Right.
And so it's a very unsound argument to say that somebody who does not have consciousness is not a human person. Then what happens every night when I go to sleep? Am I less a human person?
Yeah. And do we see where such abortion laws have changed our mindset to the point of endorsing euthanasia, where people say, oh, well, this person's dependent on this type of medical care, therefore we can intentionally kill them. This is how far this culture of death, as St. John Paul the Great referred to it, has gone. And so at the end of the day, this SLED acronym again stands for size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. It really helps you in being able to respond to some of the very silly arguments people make for abortion. And, you know, I think today people essentially allow abortion, think it's okay, whether the baby's wanted or unwanted. If the baby's wanted, we celebrate it. We have, you know, as they refer to them, the gender reveal parties. I'm so sick of the word gender. Or, you know, we have the baptism party. We have, you know, the baby shower, all of these things. But if the baby's unwanted, we can discard it and say nothing of it.
And celebrate not the baby, but the abortion, which is maybe it's not happening every time there's an abortion, but what a frightening thing that it's happening at all.
Right. Let's keep strong in our pro-life apologetics. Be willing to take on these tough conversations. You can find Father Tim on social media at
Father Tim Grumbach.
And you can find me at Timmer. If you enjoyed the show, head over to radiotrending.com for more episodes and to share your favorite episode with other friends.
This has been Trending with Timmery. To book her to speak or learn more about her guest, visit radiotrending.com. That's radiotrending.com. You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes.